to Historical Nerdery, the show that destroys the myths of the American Revolution one podcast at a time. I am your head nerd, Alexander Kane. On today's episode, we'll investigate the civilian evacuation of April 19th, 1775. I hope you will join us today on Historical Nerdery. Let's get into the show. One important aspect of the Battle of Lexington that has been often overlooked by historians is the psychological and physical impact upon the civilian populace. Hours before the engagement, at approximately 6 o'clock in the evening of April 18, 1775, Lexington resident Solomon Brown observed 9 British officers riding slowly along the country road before him. The night was not very cold, yet Brown noted that each of the officers was wearing a heavy wool blue overcoat under which he could see the shape of their pistols. Taken aback, Brown passed the officers and galloped towards Lexington. He rode directly to Monroe Tavern, where he informed Sergeant William Monroe of what he had observed. By 8 o'clock in the evening, Lexington received 2 messages from Elbridge Gerry, a member of the Massachusetts Provincial Committee of Safety and Supplies. According to the Reverend Jonas Clark, "We received 2 messages, the first verbal, the other by express, informing that 8 or 9 officers of the King's troops were seen just before night passing the road towards Lexington in a musing, contemplative posture, and it was suspected that they were out upon some evil design." At 11 o'clock in the evening, alarm rider Paul Revere arrived in Lexington, warning of a military expedition advancing from Boston. Approximately an hour later, a second alarm rider, William Dawes, arrived in Lexington and confirmed Revere's report. As a result, militia captain John Parker ordered his company to assemble. When Lexington's alarm bell began to toll, most residents recognized that a hostile military force was marching directly towards them. With the possibility of the town being subjected to plunder and destruction, a panic set in. Many from Lexington who lived along the Boston Road, also known as the Bay Road, prepared to evacuate. Others helped their sons, brothers, fathers, and husbands prepare for war. Anna Monroe, wife of Sergeant Monroe, started to bake bread for her husband. Later she confessed, "I mixed my bread last night with tears coming, for I feared that I should have no husband when the next mixing came." The Reverend William Gordon of Roxbury would later report, "The inhabitants had quitted their houses in the general area upon the road, leaving almost everything behind them, and thinking themselves well off in escaping with their lives." Some Lexington residents escaped with a few select belongings. Others quickly hid or buried valuables before leaving. One 19th century Lexington account suggests many town residents hid their silver and mirrors and many other things in an unnamed swamp. The Reverend Clark's family hid money, watches, and anything down in the potatoes. Captain John Parker's wife, Lydia, took all the valuables and hid them in a hollow trunk of a tree standing some distance from the house. Lydia Mullican and her daughters hurriedly buried the family's silver and other valuables by a stone wall near their clock shop and then fled to distant safety. Why was there a desire to protect some valuables? Naturally, a fear of looting and vandalism and theft at the hands of British troops was a contributing factor. However, it appears part of the motivation may have to do with Massachusetts colonial inheritance laws. While all property technically belonged to the husband, household movables such as textiles, furniture, the tools of domestic production, silverware and dishes were generally passed from generation to generation through the female line and were considered properly part of a woman's domestic sphere. Thus, a woman's household goods was a woman's closest representation of legitimate possessions and gave her a sense of ownership. As the panic continued to spread, for some women, the flight was particularly difficult. 4 women, Sarah Marrett, Amity Pierce, Sarah Reed, and Betty White, were still likely bedridden, having given birth over the past month. Sarah Reed and her newborn child actually had to be carried out of her home on a mattress by her husband and in-laws. 3 other women, Dorcas Parker, Elizabeth Estabrook, and Lydia Harrington, were all over 8 months pregnant. Other women rushed to get their young children to safety. Abigail Harrington took her toddlers down a lane back of the house to the old place on Smock Farm. Anna Monroe fled from the family tavern with her 3 young children and hid on a hill behind the establishment. Upon hearing the exchange of musketry from the Battle of Lexington, Lydia Parker, wife of the militia captain, sent her eldest son to the top of a nearby hill to see whether the British regulars were moving to plunder Lexington homes. Once certain that the British column had moved on to Concord, many residents of Lexington returned to the town common. Upon arrival, they discovered over 200 men from Woburn's militia and Minutemen companies had just arrived and were assisting in the treatment of the wounded. By mid-morning, residents of Lexington buried their dead in a makeshift grave. Elizabeth Clark, a child witness to the events of April 19, 1775, would write years later to a relative about her experience in the aftermath of the fight on Lexington Green. Father sent Jonas down to Grandfather Cook's to see who was killed and what their condition was, and in the afternoon, Father, Mother, with me, and the baby went to the meeting house. There was the 8 men that was killed, 7 of them my father's parishioners, one from Woburn, all in boxes made of 4 large boards nailed up, and after Pa had prayed, they were put into 2 horse carts and took into the graveyard where some of the neighbors had made a large trench, as near to the woods as possible, and there we followed the bodies of those first slain. Father, mother, I, and the baby, there I stood, and there I saw them let down into the ground. It was a little rainy, but we waited to see them covered up with clods, and then for fear the British should find them, my father thought some of the men had best cut some pine or oak boughs and spread them on their place of burial, so it looked like a heap of brush. Meanwhile, in Lincoln and Concord, news of the British expeditionary force advancing into the countryside spread. After the Lincoln Minute Companies departed for Concord, Mary Hartwell recounted, "I did up the chores of the barn, and cared for the children as well as I could in my anxiety. I feared that I should never see your grandfather again." According to Mary Hoare Farrar of Lincoln, "The Concord families living nearest to our home fled this way for safety, and with my grandmother and others of the family left this house and took refuge in Oaky Bottom, a retired piece of forest land about 1/2 mile in the rear of the house. Grandmother, in her haste, had sufficient self-possession to think of the cattle tied in the barn. These she set loose, desiring to save them from the flames that she expected would be kindled by General Gage's army. She took her babe Samuel, the third, in her arms, and bade farewell to the old dwelling, never expecting to gather her family about her again. Every little while, they would venture out as far enough to look over the hill to see if the soldiers had set the house on fire." According to the petition of Martha Moulton of Concord, on the 19th day of April, 1775, in the forenoon, the town of Concord, wherein I dwell, was beset with an army of regulars, who in a hostile manner entered the town. All our near neighbors were drawn off from the thickest part of the town, where I live, and had taken with them their families, and what of their best effects they could carry, some to a neighboring wood, and others to remote houses for security. In the aftermath of the Battle of Concord, the residents who lived along the Bay Road of Lincoln, Lexington, and Menotomy realized that the British regulars would be marching back through their towns again. As a result, the residents quickly prepared to flee to safety for a second time. One evacuee recalled that the Lexington roads were clogged with women and children weeping. Some residents escaped back to woods and fields, while others traveled to nearby towns. Some sought refuge in homes far from the British path of retreat. By the time the retreating regulars returned to Lexington, the women and children had been so scattered and dispersed that most of them were out of the way. Hannah Winthrop fled from Cambridge with her ill husband. As she recalled, "We set out not knowing whither we went. We were directed to a place about a mile from the town, but what a distressed house did we find there, filled with women whose husbands were gone forth to meet the assailants, 70 or 80 of these with numbers of infant children, crying and agonizing for the fate of their husbands. To stay in this place was impossible." Anna Monroe, daughter of William and Anna, was 5 years old when the battles of Lexington and Concord took place. After returning to Monroe Tavern following the first evacuation, the family was forced to flee again. According to her 19th century account, Anna could remember seeing the men in red coats coming towards the house and how frightened her mother was when they ran from the house. That was all she could remember, but her mother told her of her very unhappy afternoon. She held Anna by the hand, brother William by her side, and baby Sally in her arms. She could hear the cannon firing over her head on the hill, and she could smell the smoke of the three buildings which the British burned between here and the center of Lexington. And she did not know what was happening to her husband, who was fighting, or what was happening with her house. Young Anna's mother used to talk of her, and she remembered that her mother used to take her on her lap and say, "This is my little girl that I was so afraid the redcoats would get." Lincoln's Mary Hartwell also remembered coming in close contact with retreating British forces. "I saw an occasional horseman dashing by, going up and down, but heard nothing more until I saw them coming back in the afternoon, all in confusion, wild with rage and loud with threats. I knew there had been trouble, and that it had not resulted favorably for their retreating army. I heard musket shots just below by the old Brooks Tavern, and trembled, believing that our folks were being killed." In Menotomy, Hannah Adams had given birth to a daughter approximately 10 days earlier. The pregnancy and subsequent delivery were particularly difficult, and as a result, she was still bedridden on April 19th. As the British column retreated towards her village, her husband, Deacon Joseph Adams, allegedly panicked, abandoned his wife and family, and hid in a nearby hayloft. Shortly thereafter, three regulars burst into her bedroom. One threatened to kill her with his bayonet. Not all Middlesex County men saw combat on April 19, 1775, and as a result, some men were part of the civilian evacuation. A few of these men who remained with the evacuees were ministers who tended to their flocks. Others had suffered from physical injuries and as a result could not field with their militia or minute companies. At least four Lexington men missed the fighting and participated in the civilian evacuation because they were caring for their wives, mothers, or daughters. For example, Lexington's John Raymond, who was employed by William Monroe as a general laborer. Following the Battle of Lexington, Raymond kept a watch over the family tavern while Anna Monroe and her children fled the property. Early 19th century accounts have argued that Raymond was a lame man or a simple man or a cripple. However, historian John Bell has suggested that Raymond was actually an active member of Captain Parker's company and only suffered from a temporary disability on or before April 19th. Sadly, Raymond was shot and killed by British soldiers under Percy's command the afternoon of April 19th. Moses Reed and his father-in-law, Jacob Whittemore, carried Sarah Reed and her newborn child out of the family home on a mattress. It is believed that they remained with Sarah throughout the day. Teenager Joseph Estabrook and his father assisted in the carrying of his mother with a young infant named Solomon in her arms in an armchair for over a mile back from the scene of the danger. At the height of the civilian evacuation, a different panic set in as many residents of Middlesex County believed that the enslaved population would rise up, join the British Army, and kill their masters. In Menotomy, where the women and children had gathered in houses safely removed from the firing, a rumor began to circulate that the town's slaves were about to launch a revolt of their own and finish what the British had begun by murdering the defenseless women and children. When Ishmael, an enslaved man belonging to the Cutter family of Menotomy, approached the house of George Prentice, one of the many terrified women gathered inside asked, "Are you going to kill us, Ishmael?" "No," Ishmael replied. "He wasn't there to kill them. He was there to see whether his owner's wife, Mrs. Cutter, was safe." A similar fear overtook the women of Framingham. After the town's minute and militia companies mobilized for Concord, a rumor started to spread that the enslaved people of the town had risen up in revolt and were coming to massacre them all. Women and children fled to the home of the Framingham Minute Company captain. Under the leadership of the captain's wife, they armed themselves with axes and pitchforks and clubs and waited for the coming massacre that never came. In reality, many enslaved people risked their own lives by remaining relatively close to their masters' properties to safeguard homes from the British column. In West Cambridge, retreating regulars broke into the Cutter's Tavern. The soldiers carried off what they could, left the taps of the molasses and spirit casks open, destroyed furniture, drove a bayonet through the best mirror, and then set the house on fire. A family slave, however, had watched from a safe distance what had happened, and as soon as the soldiers left the property, he crossed the firefight and extinguished the flames. Many Lexington residents from the safety of distant hills watched in horror as their homes were burned, destroyed, or looted. Pursuant to 18th century law, the illegal breaking and entering into a home was a capital offense punishable by death. Thus, from an American point of view, the plundering and burning of homes was not only highly offensive, it also served to fuel their anger and despair even further. According to the Reverend Gordon, you would have been shocked at the destruction which has been made by the regulars, as they are miscalled, had you been present with me to have beheld it. Many houses were plundered of everything valuable that could be taken away, and what could not be carried off was destroyed. Looking glasses, pots, pans, etc., wantonly damaged and destroyed. Andover Minuteman Thomas Boynton would later record that upon entering Lexington, we saw houses burning and others plundered, and dead bodies of the enemy lying by the way, others taken prisoner. Another Andover Minuteman, James Stevens, recalled, we went along through Lexington and saw three or four houses was burnt, and some horses and hogs was killed. They plundered in every house they could get in, that they stove in windows and broke in tops of desks. Lydia Mulliken lost everything when her house and clock-making shop were burned to the ground. The only surviving valuables were the silver that she had hidden in a stone wall behind her house. Lydia's daughter, Rebecca Mulliken, particularly mourned the loss of a pocket, which with great pride she had embroidered with crewels. The Loring family also lost everything, including all household furnishing and every stitch of linens and clothing. Pfeiffer Jonathan Harrington's family lost an 8-day clock, clothes, books, moose skins, and other articles. Some Lexington residents discovered their residence had been vandalized and defiled as well. A Mrs. Muzzy discovered that British soldiers had broken her mirror, valuable crockery, fired bullets into an interior wall, and left the floorboards smeared with blood. When Anna Monroe returned to her family tavern, she quickly noted that the retreating regulars had eaten her freshly baked bread, broken into her supplies, and consumed all the alcohol in the shop. Her household linens were used as bandages for the wounded soldiers, and she discovered the soldiers had piled up her furniture, including a mahogany table, and set it on fire in an attempt to burn the tavern down. In the aftermath of the battles of Lexington and Concord, many Lexington residents started to compile a running list of lost, stolen, or destroyed property. Ultimately, claims for compensation were submitted to the Massachusetts Provincial Congress and the Massachusetts Legislature. The approximate damage to Lexington property from the battles of Lexington and Concord exceeded £4,500, which is equal to almost $1 million today. However, no resulting property damage could equal the horror of the loss of human life. Many of the homes along the path of the engagement in Monotomy were littered with dead militiamen and British regulars. According to Jason Russell's wife, the blood was almost ankle-deep in one of the rooms, and her house was riddled with bullets following a brutal hand-to-hand and room-to-room fight. On April 20, 1775, Hannah Winthrop and her husband started their journey to their home in Cambridge. As they passed through Monotomy, she recalled, but what added greatly to the horrors of the scene was our passing through the bloody field at Monotomy, which was strewed with mangled bodies. We met one affectionate father with a cart looking for his murdered son and picking up his neighbors who had fallen in battle in order for their burial. The Reverend David McClure would later record in his diary, "Dreadful were the vestiges of war on the road. I saw several dead bodies, principally British, on and near the road. They were all naked, having been stripped principally by their own soldiers. They lay on their faces. Several were killed, who stopped to plunder, and were suddenly surprised by our people pressing upon their rear. The houses on the road of the march were all perforated with balls, and the windows broken. Horses, cattle, and swine lay dead around. Such were the dreadful trophies of war for about 20 miles. In a letter to his son, the Reverend Andrew Elliott correctly summarized the extent of despair and anxiety the civilians of April 19, 1775 experienced. I know not what to do, not where to go. May God sanctify our distresses, which are greater than you can conceive. Such a Sabbath of melancholy and darkness I ever knew, every face gathering paleness, all hurry and confusion, others not knowing where to go. In short, after the melancholy exercises of the day, I am unable to write anything with propriety or connection. Everything distressing. Thank you for joining us on today's episode of Historical Nerdery. To learn more about the battles of Lexington and Concord, as well as other neat information about Revolutionary New England, be sure to check out my website, historicalnerdery.com, follow me on Facebook and Instagram, and subscribe to my mailing list. I'm Alex Kane, and this has been Historical Nerdery.